Okay, good morning, Shavuot Tov, everyone. I'm particularly excited for today's shiur because most of it was put together reasonably quickly. The reason I say that is because two things that we're going to be looking at today were, I don't know, published, but I came across my desk, so to speak, since Shabbos started. The first is a profile of Rav Schechter from YU in Jewish Action magazine that came out relatively recently. I just picked up a copy over Shabbos and I really enjoy the profile. I think it also helps us better appreciate some of what Rav Schechter is doing and some of the tshuvot that we see together in the series. So I'll spend a few minutes looking at that. And then the topic for today's shiur, which is lighting Hanukkah candles at shul, is appropriate both because it's timely, meaning this week is Hanukkah, really snuck up on us this year, or snuck up on me anyway. And this tshuva is one that I'm in a WhatsApp group where these tshuvot are posted, and you know, I saw it last night and I thought it was too good to pass up. So that's what we'll be working on today. So we'll start by sharing my screen, and we'll see this profile from Jewish Action magazine. I'll put the link in. I put the link in the chat, and I'll put it wherever you're listening to the recording of this year now. So this is an interview with Rav Schechter. The recent issue of Jewish Action magazine, it's a magazine put out by the OU, had a couple of elements on like halacha in the era of COVID, sort of stealing my thunder a little bit, and the thunder of many other rabbis who are giving shiurim on the same topic. It includes a number of Rav Schechter's own halachic rulings, analysis by Rabbi Gil Student of, you know, some of the changes, or whether the era of COVID represents a fundamental change in halacha, and also an interview with Rav Schechter, who's interviewed by, I think, Shaul Robinson, just to get an insight into how he thinks about his role as paskening during the era of COVID. There are a few passages that I just thought were very, very interesting. So we can start at the beginning of this section here. Rabbi Robinson asks, did the Rav, meaning referring to Rav Schechter, ever imagine that he would one day have to paskin that all our shuls and yeshivos should close? How does a posek cope with unprecedented times and with getting hundreds of questions from all over the Jewish world? And Rav Schechter responded, of course I never imagined this. But I don't think I answer more questions now than I do during an ordinary week. In the course of a year, people ask me shilas all day long. Many of the shilas are very serious, some concerning life and death. I don't think the recent shilas are more serious than those I normally get in the Beis Medrash. So that itself struck me the first time I read it. I think, you know, many in the Jewish world are walking around. Everything is unprecedented. This is all so new and so difficult. And people are even more appreciative of their poskim than they might otherwise normally be. And all of that being said, from Rav Schechter's perspective at least, it's unprecedented, but it's not crazy. He constantly deals with questions of very high stakes. And this is just another series of high stakes questions. So I think that itself is kind of interesting that, you know, depending on where you're coming from, the questions might feel, you know, new and unprecedented and very different. And at the same time, sort of within the realm of things that you might be expected to do as a posek. That was once, you know, comment that struck me. Let's see, there was another couple. One had to do with the process by which these tshuvot are written. This is something that we've alluded to in the context of another shiur, but worth seeing him describe the process. So Rav Schechter describes, Rav Reuven Tarrigan, who is the dean of overseeing students at Yeshivat HaKotel, would send me a list of questions, or the RCA would interview me and would ask me questions. The questions would be emailed to me in advance. I would handwrite a response in Hebrew. Then my wife would scan my response, because Rav Schechter doesn't use the internet or know how to use the internet by his own testimony, and email it back. After writing his own response, a group of younger Rashi Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, YU, REITs, became involved in editing the tshuvos and adding Mara Makomos. So they would be the ones who'd flesh out the written version, add some sources, make it a little bit more thorough. And then the tshuva would be translated into English, as we've seen from some of our own studies, and placed on a website. So there are a few websites that have been collecting these, YU Torah being among them. And Rav Schechter here describes the process. So he, you know, composes the basis of the answer, and then it's fleshed out by others, translated by others. And that maybe accounts for some of the discrepancies that we've seen between some of the English and Hebrew versions. But it's interesting to see this sort of view of how they're written. Many sort of classical tshuvot, if you were to open your tshuva from the Rishonim or the Achronim, many of them were written by the author of the book, you know, so to speak. So we have tshuvot from Rambam. Well, Rambam wrote letters and sent them out. And these are, you know, copies of those letters. These tshuvot are a little bit different in that they go through some kind of more rigorous editorial process, but nonetheless still represent Rav Schachter's, you know, own ruling. In terms of, his actual process and what he describes as how he comes to his decisions, I think we get a view into the humility of Rav Schachter from some of this interview as well. He said, you know, he closed at the end with this description, and I think he alludes to it once or twice elsewhere, that he doesn't feel like he's doing this new unprecedented thing, that he's trying to save a community or coming up with incredibly novel halachic rulings. He's trying to present what he thinks the halacha is. So just looking at the conclusion of this interview, Rabbi Robinson asks, in a recent shiur, Rav Schachter mentioned that sometimes a posek knows intuitively what the answer is to a shaila. Does this reflect Rav Schachter's own approach? Right, meaning he's describing this notion that sometimes you'll be so immersed in a topic or immersed in a sugya that someone will ask you a question. And while you can't point to the specific line in the specific halachic source that tells you what the answer is, by being so immersed in the concepts and in the texts and in the ideas, you might have a sense for what the answer might be. And Rav Schachter says, that doesn't apply to me. During his last few years, he describes how Rav Soloveitchik is different from himself. When Rav Soloveitchik was ill, he was not always able to discuss things at length. The head of the Kashrus Commission at the RCA called me up and asked me what the din is on a particular issue. I said, I don't know. I have to look it up in the Shulchan Aruch. Seems responsible. And the person calling said, before you look it up, what do you say? Meaning, what's your intuition? What would be your best guess? And Rav Schachter said, I have to look it up. The person on the phone said, what's your feeling, right? What's your intuition? You're someone who knows a lot of Torah. You're a posek. So tell me, what's your gut? You know, and he says the Rav used to say that he would always have an intuitive feeling about what the halacha would be. And Rav Schachter said, well, that's the Rav. The Rav is the Rav. And I'm not the Rav. I don't have that feeling, right? Despite the fact that he's, you know, functionally one of the leading poskim, if not the leading posek for the modern Orthodox community in America, still, he doesn't have that feeling. He doesn't know the halacha. He'll look it up in a book. He doesn't trust his own guts to make these kinds of calls when he doesn't know the right answer and isn't able to point to it. And this sort of tone of humility comes across in this interview. I really encourage everyone to read it if they haven't had the chance. I'll share the link again in the chat very briefly before we move on to our topic for today. I just couldn't help myself but looking at this interview together to see who Rav Schachter is when we read some of his tshuvot together. So I'll stop sharing now. I'll briefly post this into the chat. If anyone has any questions in the interim while I do that, and otherwise we will move on to the topic for today. Okay. All right. So moving on from that introduction, we'll now start with our main halachic topic for the day, which is lighting candles in shul under the circumstances in which we currently conduct shul. So it's a little bit, let's put it this way. We'll start with a little bit of background into the idea of lighting Hanukkah candles in shul, where it comes from, what its purpose might be. And then by doing so, we'll get a better appreciation of, I guess, for lack of a better term, the problem that Rav Schachter is trying to solve in his tshuva. If we were to jump in, we wouldn't quite appreciate it, so we're going to give ourselves a little bit of background before we do so. I'll share my screen again with the source sheet for today. Okay, so after our introduction, we had seen this interview. We're now going to look at the, you know, origin and basis for this minhag. We'll see that it really is more of a minhag than it is a formal halacha. And discern some of the details, and then we'll start noticing where the problems might come from, and where the challenges of COVID might come from. Because otherwise, what would be the problem with lighting candles in shul now during COVID? It should be the same as being open. If you're open, you're able to light candles. If not, you're not. But we'll see how it gets developed. So the halacha is sort of most concisely articulated in the Shulchan Aruch, as it often is. Shulchan Aruch rules, Madlikim u'mevarchim bebeit ha-knesset mishum pirsumei nisa. We light candles with a bracha in the Beit Knesset, in Shul, because of pirsumei nisa, in order to publicize the miracle of Chanukah. The phrase pirsumei nisa should be common. In fact, it's one of the underlying halachot about lighting candles on Chanukah at all. The whole idea of lighting candles on Chanukah is to publicize the miracle of Chanukah. And many of the halachot about where one lights and when one lights come from that basis. And another aspect of this pirsumei nisa seems to be lighting in shul, shul being a public place where many people will see and be thereby reminded of the miracle. The Rama adds an important caveat, which I don't want to say is undisputed, but I didn't find a strong voice who was disputing this ruling in the Rama. Ve'ein adam yotzei b'neirot shel beit ha-knesset. A person doesn't fulfill their actual obligation of lighting Hanukkah candles with the candles that are lit in shul. V'tzarech lachzor u'lahadlik b'beito. And a person must go home and light their own Hanukkah candles at home. Right? You can't light candles at shul and then not light at home anymore. You light at shul and then you'll return home and you'll light in that context as well. And that'll fulfill your actual obligation. The Rama then rules, and we'll continue with the Rama, and then we'll provide ourselves a little bit of background. V'noagin lahalik b'beit ha-knesset bein mincha l'mariv. When do we light in shul? According to the Rama, we light between mincha and mariv, which is actually a little bit earlier than one might light if one were at home. Right? When one lights at home, typically it's preferable to wait until after Tzeda Kochavim, until after three stars appear in the sky, which is later than the time that one would do Mincha Mariv, right? The latest that one might daven Mincha and Mariv together at Shul would be at Shkia, at sunset, which is a good deal before Tzeda Kochavim. So we light a little bit early, which is itself weird and will come back to us in a little bit. And then the Rama adds, V'yish nohagim lahadlik be'erev Shabbos kodem Mincha. And Erev Shabbos, apparently, they would even light before Mincha, which is, you know, even more surprising on some level. That would be, you know, really before nightfall. So on Erev Shabbos, everyone is sort of pressured into that. And as much as you can't light after nightfall on Shabbos, because then it's Shabbos. And that's what we do. We'll light Hanukkah candles first, and then Shabbos candles. Okay, well, we'll stop there. So in this source, we've seen the basic idea of lighting Hanukkah candles in the Beit Knesset. We've also seen that one doesn't fulfill their mitzvah thereby, right? The base mitzvah of Hanukkah, as it appears in the Gemara and is codified in halachic sources, is ner ishu beto. The one must light for their household, in their house. And that becomes the sort of dominant halacha. And there are lots of, you know, complications that might arise from this. Does one light when one is a guest? Does one light when one is traveling? And so on. But the base mitzvah is to light when one's house, not in one's shul. But there is such a minhag. And that when one lights in shul, one does so between mincha and mariv, or on Erev Shabbos, sometimes even before mincha. Okay, now where does this halacha or minhag come from? It seems from a few sources that this is a relatively early minhag. You know, in the centuries before the Shulchan Aruch was written, it seems to exist. And while it originated with apparently some controversy, it seems to have become, I don't want to say universal, but, you know, reasonably well attested afterwards. So, for example, it's referenced in this source in the Shiboli Haleket, which predates the Shulchan Aruch by some period of time. He mentions this minhag. V'gam anu nohagim lahadlik b'beit ha-knesset, v'lo yadanu shoresh va'anaf l'minhag hazeh. We have this practice of lighting Hanukkah candles in the Beit Knesset, and we don't know the root of this minhag at all. And moreover, umori Rabbi Yehuda achi sheni, at least one Rav, or Rav Yehuda, the brother of the Shiboli Haleket, wouldn't want to light in Beit HaKnesset because he wouldn't want people to mistakenly think that they should make a bracha on it, which I'll note, we actually do. So our practice is not in accordance with the source. But there were so those who objected. You shouldn't light on candles that one lights in shul. V'chein da'atinota, and I, the Shiboli Haleket, agree with this halacha. Because everyone's going to be lighting at home anyway, and because one is only obligated to light at home, why would you ever need to light at shul? Meaning, if you have this notion that, you know, a person has their own obligation to light, well, that person is going to light at home, so they don't need to light at shul. Now it's true, ilu hayu orchem yishenim beit haknesset, hayu heim tzrichem lahadlik. If you had guests who were sleeping at shul, which seems to have been common in those times, people who were visiting the community would sleep in the shul. So if someone's sleeping in the shul, that becomes their house. Dekai malan achsanai chayev b'ner Chanukah, because guests, we assume, are obligated in lighting Chanukah candles. So even if one doesn't live somewhere, if one is visiting a location and sleeping there for the night, they'll light Chanukah candles there. So if someone is sleeping in shul, fine, I get lighting Chanukah candles in the shul under those circumstances. V'im ein sham orchim matzarach lahadlik. But if there aren't, then why would you bother lighting? So he objects to this minhag. What's the point of lighting in shul if there aren't people who are living in shul and you're only supposed to light Chanukah candles in your home where you live? Despite these objections from the Shibboleth HaLeket and a few others who've also objected, also worth noting that sort of the more major Rishonim, those who, you know, sort of serve as the foundation or the basis of much of contemporary halacha, the Rambam, the Rif, other, you know, major Rishonim don't seem to have this minhag. But a lot of later ones and slightly more minor figures do have it, and that becomes the basis for our practice. So, for example, we see in the source called the Kolbo a description of this minhag and some of the various purposes that it might serve. V'nahagu kol ha'makomot lahadlik ner Chanukah bebeit ha'knesset lehotzi mi she'eino baki v'she'eino zariz bezot. Number one is that lighting in the Beit Knesset will be able to fulfill the mitzvah for the person who doesn't know how, mi she'eino baki, or maybe won't be careful to actually perform the mitzvah. People who, for some reason, will not light Chanukah candles on their own can sort of fulfill the mitzvah with this lighting at shul. This is a very challenging and an odd kind of position, right? Based on what we said before, the mitzvah of lighting Chanukah candles is based in one's home. And if it's based in one's home, then it's unclear how lighting in shul would fulfill the mitzvah for anyone else. But okay, let's leave that to the side for now. Just note that that's an aspect of this. He also raises, I guess, three other factors in quick succession that become the major spectrum of opinions. Gam ki hi hu hidur ha-mitzvah, it beautifies the mitzvah by doing it in a public communal setting. That's number one. Number two, upirsum hanes, what we had seen in the Shulchan Aruch, that you're publicizing the miracle, and one does that effectively when one is at shul with its zibur, with a community. And v'zecher le-mikdash. It is a memory or a commemoration of that which was done in the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash also had a menorah that was lit, and our shul is functioning as a sort of mikdash ma'at, as a miniature replica Beit HaMikdash, also have candles lit in them, at least sometimes. Excuse me. He also notes at the end, v'harayved zal cholik al zeh ha-minhag kamo shekatavnu, the Ravid objected to the minhag, among others. But nonetheless, the Kolbo has its minhag and justifies it on three or four different grounds. So this becomes much closer to the basis for our practice. I'll just briefly point to the Sefer HaManhig, which is also a collection of minhag and psak, where he sort of corroborates what we saw in the Kolbo. Virli de'in chiyuva b'bit ha'knesset lahadlik ner shalachanaka klal ela b'bayit adam darbo. The mitzvah really is only in one's house, not in one's shul. But ala nahagu kach al zeh sheha'nes ba b'mikdash beit olamim. The miracle of Chanukah happened in the Beit HaMikdash. That's where the oil lasted for 8 days, when it was only expected to last for one. That was the location of the miracle. Ve'usim kmokim b'mikdash ma'at begola. And therefore, we do our own pirsumei nisa in our own mikdash, because that was the location of the mikdash. The reason I like the source is because it adds an extra small element to the Pursume Nisa argument. It's not only Pursume Nisa in a more quantitative sense, more people are seeing Chanukah candles more, but also qualitatively. The minhag was located in the Beit HaMikdash, and so in our own miniature Beit HaMikdash that a shul functions as, we also have to light Chanukah candles as part of that commemoration. Then he also adds at the end, Lafisha Kulam and Kabzim Sam, there's also this element that people, you know, gather together. But that seems to be the sort of foundation on some level of this minhag. So to summarize this section, we've seen the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah who introduced the minhag into codified practical halacha. And while this minhag originally was controversial, the likes of the Shibboleth HaLeket, the Ravid, objected to it or thought it was at least purposeless. There were others who justified the minhag on some grounds. And though this goes a little bit too far beyond our scope for today, we then see later sources that even justify saying it with a bracha, right? Saying a bracha on a mitzvah, we understand. We light Hanukkah candles at home, we say a bracha. But if this is just a minhag, a zecher, a mikdash, some kind of extra bonus thing that we do, the idea of saying a bracha isn't so obvious. And there's a discussion in halachic sources about how we justify that. But that's a little bit too far afield, so we won't go into that discussion right now. I'll take a pause if anyone has any questions or observations. I'd love to hear them. And otherwise, we'll move on to some of the discussion that will begin to introduce problems that Rav Shachar will then need to solve for us. Okay. So Rav Shachar begins by identifying a problem. We'll see the original sources in which the problem comes out most explicitly, and then see Rav Shachar's presentation. A lot of Rav Shachar's presentation will be based on the halachic positions of Rav Soloveitchik. And we have a brief summary of them, and I also sent it to the chat and have as one of my documents where Rav Soloveitchik fleshes out his ideas more fully. We'll get to those, please God, if we have time. So the additional source, and this is where Rav Shachar really begins, comes from the Mor Uktzia, who raises an extra halacha for us. When one lights in shul, v'nira da'al kol panim ein lahadlik b'bracha, one should not light with a bracha, im ein sham asara b'beit ha'knesset, unless there are 10 men at tzibor in the Beit Knesset, one shouldn't light Hanukkah candles with a bracha there. And he infers that from some earlier precedent. Bekarov be'enai shehi bracha levatala. It would be a bracha levatala to do so, or he thinks it's very likely it would be a bracha levatala. It would be an unnecessary bracha, which one shouldn't say. Dele persume nisa lo sagi delav asara. Because in order to fulfill persume nisa, you need at least a tzibor. You need at least the asara that he describes. Okay. So far, that's still not really a problem for us, because to the extent that shuls are open, minyanim are happening there. So having 10 people shouldn't be a huge problem on those grounds. And if they are ever a problem, it would be because shul being open itself is a problem. And then we wouldn't have any sort of issue to deal with. I feel obligated to note that the Bior Halacha objects and argues with the Mor Uktzia and says you don't really need a minyan for this purpose. Right, the Mor Uktzia said that in order to properly publicize the miracle, you need asara, you need a tzibur. The Bior Halacha says, no, who says? Right, there's no requirement that when one lights Hanukkah candles in your home, that you light them with a minyan present, or you light them in a way that 10 people will pass by on the street and see them. The Pirsumei Nisa is by lighting the candle at all. So he objects to this notion of the Mor Uktzia. But the Mor Uktzia does ground it in having a minyan. I think we'll now... we'll now segue to Rav Shachter, and we'll jump back and look at some of these other sources as they come up. But what Rav Shachter does with this source, based on the Torah of Rav Soloveitchik, starts building the challenge for us. So Rav Shachter begins as follows. He cites the Ramah, from which we saw our minhag of lighting candles in the Beit HaKnesset between Mincha and Maariv. Then he cites the Mor Uktzia, where he says you need at least a minyan at the time that you light Hanukkah candles. We noted that's not a universal opinion, but there are at least some in the period of the Achronim who articulated that need, that you really needed a minyan to do so. Now, Rav Soloveitchik is going to develop this idea a little bit further based on his own father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Verabenu, Rav Shachter saying Rabbeinu refers to the Rav. Amar Bazeh b'shem Aviv ha'gon Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. She'afilu yesham asara, even if there are 10 people there, zel lo maspik. That's not enough. You don't need 10 people to constitute the tzibur. Uba'in and davka lahalik ben mincha l'mariv. Ve'afilu b'erev Shabbos. You need to light between Mincha and Maariv, even on Erev Shabbos, right? The Ramah said that you would light before Mincha. The Rav says, no, you have to light after Mincha. Why? D'bishah shehit palalu Mincha ba'asara. At the time that Mincha was davened with 10 people, nitztarfu yachad litzor tzibur. He thinks there's a difference between the number of people that join together to make a minyan and the minyan itself. 10 men aren't automatically a minyan. They have to be joined together in order to make a minyan. V'atziruf lo hitbatel, ki bedatam lehitpalal ma'ariv, tekef umiyad ba'asara, v'nimtza she'osim az hadlaka b'tzibur. So when they daven mincha together, these, you know, 10 disparate individuals come together to constitute a tzibur. They become a community. And because they're going to be davening ma'ariv imminently, they stay formed in that way as a community. And it's important that one lights when one has a tzibur, not just 10 individuals, but the community that is created by those individuals. And then he has this, I found this line, it's very enjoyable to read. Distam asara, she yoshvim v'korim biyachad et ha-morgan journal, aims en nikrit tzibur. When 10 people are sitting around together, they're reading the Morgan Journal, which I think refers to the morning newspaper. So if 10 people are sitting reading the newspaper, you don't become a tzibur just because there are 10 of you. How do you become a tzibur? Uba'inan bidavka shenitstarfu yachad le'iza davar shebikdusha. You need 10 people who join together for one of the dvarim shebikdusha, for one of those parts of davening for which one needs a minyan. Then when 10 people join together and perform that thing, you become a minyan. You become a tzibur that you need to light with. Hatzarach abidin asara. Right. And then, you know, so if you need a minyan, then the problem is going to be on Motzei Shabbos. And the Rav describes here how one deals with Motzei Shabbos. We'll skip this section just in the interest of time. But he basically describes how on Motzei Shabbos, sometimes what'll happen is one will be able to light before Havdalah, because Havdalah, according to the Rav, is when the tzibur sort of dissolves itself. After Havdalah on Motzei Shabbos, you're saying Aleinu, but at that point the tzibur really no longer exists. And if you light after Aleinu, you're not really lighting with the tzibur, you're lighting with a group of individuals again, because there is no Davar Shebek Jusha, there's no tzibur activity that is binding everyone together. Okay, so he makes that claim about Havdalah. Now we're going to see our problem. Vehi'iru kama rabbanim. Shebekama batei knesset hinhigu lehashmit achshav kiddush vehavdalah bebeit haknesset machmat chashash sakana. There are many shuls that have stopped saying kiddush and Havdalah as a shul because of the sakana. They want to minimize the extra amount of exposure, the extra time that it takes, possibly the idea of taking off a mask to drink, you know, grape juice for Kiddush or Havdalah. So we've stopped saying those things. V'im kain, le'ela hamadaktikim linho kedivri hagon of Moshe Soloveitchik. If you follow this halachic position of the Rav and of Moshe Soloveitchik, that you really need not only 10 people, but also 8 tzibur that is joined together for some halachic purpose, how are you going to be able to light Hanukkah candles in shul on Motzei Shabbos? Right? If you don't say Havdalah, then you have to find the time to light where you still have a tzibur that exists. So Rosh Hashanah makes the following claim. Yesh lahem lahadlik ner Chanukah bebeit haKnesset, kodem kaddish titkabel. They should really light Chanukah candles in shul before kaddish titkabel. That's the kaddish on Motzei Shabbos that will say to sort of close off davening, right? After Ashmona Esrei, we'll always conclude with the Kaddish Titkabel. The reason we call it that is the line, Titkabel Tzlotonu Va'otohon Dochobet Israel. It's a prayer about our prayers being accepted. And that represents the close of our tefillah. First we daven, and then we say in Kaddish, may the prayer that we just offered you be accepted, or the prayer that Beit Israel offered be accepted. And at that point, sort of tefillah is rounded out. And so on Motzei Shabbos, according to Rav Schechter, that's when one should make sure to light Hanukkah candles if you're not going to say Havdalah and Shul, because at that point you still have a tzibur that had joined together for the purposes of Shmona Esrei that has not yet closed off their tefillah. He also offers another potential solution. Inami, maybe you could argue a different practical solution. Im darkam tamid kol hashana ledaktik, shemishu yomar kaddish achar aleinu, afilu im ein sham avel. There are some communities where someone will say Kaddish after Aleinu, even if nobody is mourning, even if nobody needs to say Kaddish, nonetheless, they'll have someone say Kaddish. So that Kaddish is one of the Dvarim Shebekdusha, for which one requires a minyan. And that's still a point at which the tzibur is joined together. And so maybe you could rely on that Kaddish to keep everyone bound together and really like anytime before before that Kaddish. So he says, right, Umemela Shapir Dami Lahadig Ner Chanukah Afilu La'achar Kaddish Tit Kabel. Excuse me. Because you could say it after that Kaddish because we still have another Kaddish that's going to be binding everyone together. Then what he does, which is beautiful, we have to see it inside in the original source, but he quotes this position of the Gra. What the Gra does is offers another interpretation of the Persume Nisa factor in lighting candles in shul. And he says, what's the basis for this minhag? Raya mi halal b'leile psachem. There are those who have the minhag of saying halal on the Seder night before the Seder itself, after davening in shul. People will say halal. The umrim b'beit ha-knesset mishum pirsume nisa. We'll say halal not only in the Seder itself, where it's supposed to be, where it's nitkan al hakos in the language of the Gra, but based on that original, on that halal, we also have this notion of halal in shul. And the Rav develops this idea that once you have a notion of pirsume nisa in individual contexts, that you could also translate that pirsume nisa into more communal contexts. Because of the running out of time, we won't look at the full presentation in the Rav's writings here in Nefesh HaRav, where this is fleshed a little bit more fully. But we'll just look at this very brief phrase, Kolomar, Dechol chovat hayachid shetachlita l'shem pirsume nisa, any individual obligation that is rooted in the notion of publicizing the miracle, hofechet liot gam chovat hatzibor, also becomes a communal obligation, bechtei l'hasig al gedei kach yoter pirsume nisa, in order to achieve a greater level of pirsume nisa. So halal on the Seder night is at least in part a fulfillment of pirsume nisa, publicizing the miracle of our redemption from Mitzrayim. And so it also takes on a communal aspect, and we say it in at Tzibur, or at least some have a minhag of doing so. So two Hanukkah candles, which are a mitzvah based in pirsume nisa for the individual, and also become a communal institution of pirsume nisa. And because they become a communal institution of pirsume nisa, you need a proper community to have been created. And that's what Rav Shachter describes here at the end. Right? Because it is a pirsume nisa based halacha, min hanachon lekaima b'tzibur. It needs to be accomplished not only with a large number of individuals, but with a tzibur that is, you know, appropriately constituted. And that's Rav Shachter's sort of major chiddush in this presentation. We have this issue. According to the Rav, Rav Shachter's teacher, we need to light Hanukkah candles with a tzibur, and the way we conduct davening these days doesn't necessarily allow us to have a tzibur at the times when we want one. And so what he's trying to do is finding moments during our reconstructed davening where we're still at tzibur, meaning where we're still bound together by the prospect of dvarim shebekdusha, of certain tzibur-related tefillah activities that we need to do together. It is at those moments and only during those moments when we're supposed to light Hanukkah candles. So that's one thing that, you know, I don't yet have the pleasure of davening in Avad Achim on a weekly basis, so I won't see how things are conducted there, but I'll be curious how they choose to light Hanukkah candles during the newly constructed tefillah service. Now, there's one last thing I'll note, which comes at the end of Rav Shachter's presentation, and just in the interest of seeing, you know, most of a full tshuva together, we'll look at it. He raises some other issues that relate to some of the ideas we had seen earlier. Achena nira lehosif. Shebekama mekomot adayin mitpalalim b'chutz lebeit ha-knesset. There are some places where we're still not davening inside of shul, where people are having outdoor minyanim. Uf lefamim b'chutz mamish, sometimes really even outdoors. Ulefamim b'chadarim achayim b'binyan beit ha-knesset. Sometimes just we're spreading out our minyanim so that not all of them are happening in shul. We'll be using other rooms in the building, backyard minyanim, maybe non-shul buildings. Ubebit Yosef hevi sheyesh dei barishonim. There are some sources that we've seen, and the Beit Yosef quotes, Da minag lahadlik bebet ha-knesset bebracha miyuzat al-kach shebet ha-knesset dino kemikdash ma'at. The reason we light in Beit Knesset is not only because that's a place where a large number of people will be, but also because of its status as a miniature Beit HaMikdash. We had seen that in our sources in the Sefer HaManhig, for example, that we light in Beit HaKnesset because it represents the Beit HaMikdash where the miracle itself took place. According to these opinions, if you're not lighting in the main sanctuary of a shul, the places that are designated with the kedusha that a Beit HaKnesset has, you maybe should not light Hanukkah candles with a bracha in those other locations. So if you're davening outside, for example, maybe it's not appropriate to light Hanukkah candles with a bracha outside, or even in other non-shul locations. The Safek Brachot Lahakel. Because if the basis of lighting with a bracha is on this idea of Zechar LeMikdash, on the correspondence between our own Beit Knesset and the Beit HaMikdash, in which the miracle originally took place, then if we lack the connection, we probably should not say those brachot. Aval Pi, Rosh Hashanah concludes, even though it's now been several months where we've been davening in these locations, that doesn't imbue them with the same sanctity that a Beit HaKnesset itself actually has. So even though these are now our semi-permanent minyanim, davening outdoors and parking lots and other buildings and other rooms, those still aren't real shuls. That's something that in general is worthy of keeping in mind, that there is some difference between the places where we daven and the shul that we, you know, create as a community, and their, you know, halakhic ramifications and also personal spiritual ramifications to davening in your shul as opposed to in the place where you've been davening recently. And here's maybe one of the halakhic ramifications. If it's not a shul, it does not have the kedusha of a shul or the kedusha of a mikdash, and so we shouldn't be lighting with a bracha there. So to the extent that minyanim are happening outdoors, Rav Shechter would presumably prefer that one not make a bracha when one lights candles in that context. So just to summarize everything that we've seen together, after looking at Rav Shechter's own description of his own process in posking these questions, which itself was an interesting framing for the series that we're doing, we've seen the basis and origin of the minhag to light in shul, even though the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles is really based in the home. We saw the original sort of controversy about it, those who debate whether it's an appropriate minhag, and the reasons that are brought by its advocates. Some combination of publicizing the miracle, fulfilling the mitzvah for those who don't have, who aren't otherwise able to fulfill it. Zechar LeMikdash, a commemoration of the miracle in the Beit HaMikdash, or the lighting of the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash. And then we saw Rav Shechter's presentation of the Rav's position that it isn't just doing it in a large group of people that is the minhag, but the minhag is to light Hanukkah candles in shul with a tzibur, and how important it is when one changes up the formulation of davening, as we have, to nonetheless leave the integrity of the tzibur intact when one lights Hanukkah candles. With that, we'll close. I'll stop sharing my screen and stop recording.